Because we are extremely fortunate today and for the next hour or so for the conversation that we are going to have. We have two extraordinary panelists to explore with you not necessarily the political and economic and practical implications of the exponential rise of China on the world stage, but rather the intellectual and ideological foundations of China itself. This, after all, is a festival of ideas, and I thought it would be especially appropriate, particularly with guests like this, to spend some time talking about the very idea of China and what China means to itself and to the world. We have a philosopher and Confucian scholar who will help us understand the continuing relevance of centuries, if not millennia, of intellectual traditions. And we also have a historian who has written some of the most important books about China in the 20th century, and most recently, Mao's Last Revolution. And I will just put in a pitch for that book, which is absolutely wonderful. And Professor McFarquhar will be signing that book immediately after this in our bookstore. Duwei Ming is a professor of Chinese history and philosophy at Harvard. He's familiar to many of you who have been part of the Aspen Institute for some time because he's been one of our most distinguished moderators of our seminars on Asian values and philosophy. He has taught at many other universities around the world. He's written and edited many books, including Confucian Spirituality and Confucianism and Human Rights. He is currently studying the modern transformation of Confucian humanism, if you will, in East Asian and Confucian ethics as a spiritual resource, not just for the Chinese and Asians, but in fact for the entire global community. Roderick McFarquhar is professor of history and political science and the director of the John Fairbank Center for East Asian Research at Harvard as well. He's had an incredibly varied career as a journalist and media commentator. When I lived in England, he was actually a member of parliament. And then he came to the United States, where he was a founding editor of the China Quarterly. And as I mentioned, he's written many, many books on China. And he continues to write frequently in journals as well. As a matter of fact, if you've seen the latest New York Review of Books, he has a wonderful review about Mao and Nixon, which is really quite fascinating. So we have a Chinese intellectual historian who has traced and chronicled the ideological currents of modern China. And we have a Chinese philosopher who has written extensively of the Confucian, Taoist, and Buddhist philosophical underpinnings of China. I have asked each of them to get us started this afternoon, and then I'll have a question or two and then open it up to the audience, to help us understand what I think is enormously important for us to understand not only China today, but where it may move going forward. But what are the ideas underlying China today? We all sense the tremendous tensions between capitalism and communism, communitarianism, and many other things that seem to exist in tension, if not schizophrenia, in China today. But what underlies it? What motivates it? And what kind of support for these ideas and underlying ideas and philosophies of China do we have in the populace of China at large, as well as the elites of China? So first, I've asked Professor McFarquhar to speak to us. And after he speaks, Professor Du will speak to us, and then we will begin a conversation. Thank you.
If I ever get there.
Be careful.
Well, I'm very grateful to DHL and to the Aspen Institute for having me on this wonderful and apparently unusual weather. At the beginning session, which Wei Wing was one of the speakers, they were given 3 minutes for one big idea. We've given ourselves about 10 to 15, so maybe I can put three ideas in front of you. The first one I want to put in front of you, and I'm sure that most of you have traveled to China, know about China, read about China, the amazing changes that have taken place in the last three decades and how the country and certainly the coastal areas have been transformed into much richer places. And it's very easy to look at Beijing, to look at Shanghai, to look at a number of other cities and to say this is a very powerful nation. And the first idea, therefore, that I want to try and get across to you is the idea of fragility, that this system actually is a fragile system. And I want to illustrate it briefly. Any political system could be represented as a triangle with a leader at the top, a bureaucracy supporting the leader, running the country, some kind of a national ideology, whether it's the American dream, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness that permeates the society and links it to the state. And at the bottom, the military or the police there to support the civil power if necessary. The difference between a democratic system and democratic society and China is that a democratic society, the society surrounds the state, is bigger than the state, or it ought to be bigger than the state. Maybe when de Gaulle was president of France, there was a little bit sticking out at the top there. But otherwise, it is the society surrounding the state. In the case of China, we have that same triangle. And here was Mao, and here were the CCP, that's the Chinese Communist Party cadres. Here was Marxism, Leninism, later on added Mao Zedong thought, and at the bottom, the People's Liberation Army. And this was a very powerful system that they set up in 1949 after the revolution. What happened, however, to the system under Mao and then under Deng in different ways was a destruction of that triangle. Mao became even bigger during the Cultural Revolution of 66 to 76. But he destroyed the party. This side of the triangle became very, very loose because he had encouraged society here in the center, hemmed in previously by the state system, to attack the party. The Red Guards, many of you will remember, many of you are old enough to remember, and the Red Guards then were no longer under the control of the party, and society generally was out of control, which is why the Chinese talk about the chaos of the Cultural Revolution. The ideology, Mao's ideology, Mao Zedong thought, became very powerful, and the military took over for the party. Now, what we have under Deng Xiaoping was an attempt to rehabilitate the party, but never successfully managing to restore the legitimacy of the party. You know, if all the members of Congress were indicted for corruption tomorrow, it wouldn't just be everyone shrugging their shoulders. They might think there was something wrong with the Congress. So that when the party was attacked during the Cultural Revolution, it wasn't just the individual party leaders who were seen as being corrupt, as being anti-Marxist. It was the party itself which lost legitimacy and authority. So at the end of the Cultural Revolution, when Deng Xiaoping came back, he could not restore the full authority of the party. The military was still there, but here, on the ideological side, he realized that Mao Zedong thought, while it could not be discarded, it was part of the legitimation of the party, no one should pay attention to Marxism, Leninism, and Mao Zedong thought any longer, because what was vital after the Cultural Revolution was that the people should become convinced that the party was now committed to their betterment. And if that was the case, it didn't matter what you did. You didn't have to listen to doctrine. You had to find new ways of developing the economy, hacking deals with foreigners, and so on. And so he opened up the society and encouraged people to think new thoughts, to go abroad, and people no longer thought the party was something which they had to obey and respect. Of course, if there was any danger from the party, then obviously they would lie low. But this was a society that Deng Xiaoping unleashed, following on Mao, which was very much out of control as compared with the early years of the regime. So what we have now is a fragile system because the ideology in Confucian times and in communist times, Marxism, Leninism, that was what glued the whole thing together. And without that ideology, China has, in effect, lost its bearings. The leaders have no means of convincing society, which is now all over the place, of what it is that links them together. Hu Jintao, the current leader, has talked about the harmonious society. His predecessor, Jiang Zemin, talked about the three represents. We represent everyone. Deng Xiaoping talked about building socialism and Chinese characteristics. That was nonsense. If you want to build socialism and Chinese characteristics, you go to Singapore. If you want democracy with Chinese characteristics, you go to Taiwan. If you want capitalism Chinese characteristics, then you go to Hong Kong. So what is China today? China today is 1.3 billion people with Chinese characteristics, but without a soul, without an ideology connecting society and the state. There is a great big vacuum there where once there was Confucianism, and then after the revolution of 1911, there was eventually Marxism and Leninism. That doesn't exist any longer, which is why you have the growth of Christianity across the country. There are more Christians today, Catholics and Protestants, both in official churches and in house churches, than ever during the years when foreign missionaries were allowed into China. And then the revival of Buddhism, local cults. Du Weiming will talk more about that, I suspect. And most important and most alarming for the regime, because it was so well organized, like they were in their youth, and it drew upon Chinese roots, the Falun Gong, who suddenly, when they were angry in 1999, they appeared on the steps of the central government, and they demanded redress of the insults poured upon them, and the central public security had no idea that they were going to come. And so you have this vacuum. What is going to fill it? Now, in the 80s, of course, the ability of young people to go abroad, of ideas to come in from abroad, enabled people to start thinking, maybe there was a better way to run China. I'm not saying that Jefferson was walking in the streets of Beijing, but there were people thinking about, how do we prevent things like the Great Famine of the late 50s and early 60s? How do we prevent something like the Cultural Revolution from ever happening again? How do we better govern this country? And that's what led to the Tiananmen demonstrations in 1989, and not just in Beijing, but across China in about 100 cities. And to prove the fragility at that time of this system, this was a political problem, but the Chinese could not solve it by political means. The Politburo Standing Committee, five people, split three ways. Two for military law, two against martial law, and one abstention. And so Deng Xiaoping had finally, to solve a political problem, had to call in the military to suppress it, as you all know. So this is a fragile society with a vacuum in its soul. I'm not saying that average Chinese any more than the average American goes around all day saying, what is the meaning of life? Why am I here on earth? But they do know that you do not live by bread alone. And it's that vacuum that worries the Chinese leadership, why they try to put something in its place. And it's also a reflection of, and this is my third idea, it's also a reflection of a problem of national identity. And this is a problem which has haunted Chinese intellectuals ever since the advent of the West with the First Opium War in 1839. And that is, as they gradually realize that they had to change their system somehow because otherwise they wouldn't survive as China, what did it mean to be both Chinese and modern? The first solution they had was, we must preserve Chinese learning for the essence and Western learning for the practical use. Well, in those days you could say that because you knew what Chinese learning was. It was the Confucian social and political ideology and all that it meant for the society and the state. Under Mao, you knew what it was. It was Marxism and Leninism, Mao Zedong thought. That was the Chinese essence. Now there is no Chinese essence. And it's very worrying, particularly to the elite. The average peasant is not worrying about it every day, but to the elite who have to guide China, it is very worrying. I remember an interview I did in 1988 with one of the senior scholar bureaucrats of China, now in exile in this country. And he'd just come back from his first trip to India. And he said it was really quite amazing. You know, there were these Indians. Most of the men wore Western dress. They all pretended to speak in English, the elite. And they sent their kids to Western-type schools or to universities and colleges in England and in America. And there were even signs of the old colonial regime, a few statues here and there, a few roads still not had their names changed. And yet, without any doubt, without any question, these people are Indians. What have we Chinese been worried about for the last 150 years? And I think one of the answers to that is that Indians never identified themselves with the state and its ideology in the way that Chinese did down through the ages. And without that ideology, without some sense of what it is that means this is a Chinese identity, there the elite is, in effect, rudderless. And I think that the problem for the Chinese at the moment is that there's only one way that they can really try to get the people close to them, and that is the nationalist route. But they know well from modern Chinese history that's a very dangerous two-edged weapon, nationalism. If they roused anti-Japanese feeling, which is the easiest thing to do in China, if they were not tough enough with the Japanese, and they don't want to be because they have good trade relations, good aid relations with them, if they're not tough enough with the Japanese, then it could be quite possible, as has happened before in Chinese history, that the people would turn against them, the government, for not defending China's honor. So they are seeking for ways to find an ideology that will blend the society and state in traditional manner. And they don't realize that those days have passed and that the only way that a state, a nation state, which is what they are now, can blend its people with the government is what Sun Yat-sen realized at the beginning of the 20th century, and that is for the government, for the state, to have a mandate from the people. And somehow, some way, in the future, they will have to creep towards democracy. How it will be, what it'll look like, who knows? Japanese democracy does not look anything like a British or American democracy. So it could be quite conceivably something else. But that they have to change and move in that direction, and it may be sooner, it may be later, I have no doubt. The real tragedy about China's development in the last 200 years is that the really big changes come only after really big catastrophes. It was only after the defeat by Japan at the end of the 19th century and the defeat by the Western powers and Japan in the suppression of the Boxer Uprising in 1900 that finally the Empress Dowager gave way and the way was clear for the abandonment of the Confucian state system. It was only after the disaster of the Cultural Revolution that Deng Xiaoping said, this has got to change, we cannot do this to ourselves again. One must only hope that since the Chinese people have suffered so many disasters in the last 60 years of the Chinese Communist rule, that they won't have to face another disaster in order to move down that path towards a true amalgam of state and society in a more democratic system. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Elliot, and fellow participants of this marvelous Ideas Festival. Rod has already offered us a brilliant diagnostic reading of the Chinese situation, fragility of the political structure despite economic vibrancy, this ideological vacuum, and earnest quest for new national and cultural identity. I would like to make a few complimentary remarks. Let me first offer a historical note. The impact of the West since the Opium War in 1939 was so unprecedented in Chinese history that Li Hongzhang once made the observation 3,000 years of Chinese history never encounter something of this nature. If we have to use the Chinese imagination, then the possibility, totally counterfactual, the possibility of thinking about the brute force of the Mongols that conquered China in the 14th century and ruled China for 80 years. And the gradual transformation of China by the Indian influence through Buddhism over a period of 800 years. If you combine these two experiences and compress them into one century, you have some sense of the impact of the West. But it's not just military might, but also ideas and culture, the soft power, and of course institutions such as market economy, democratic polity, and civil society. So it's understandable the impact was so powerful that the Middle Kingdom was extremely difficult to deal with the situation. We know on the eve of the Opium War, the Chinese economy was perhaps one-third of world economy. And the trade between China and Great Britain was basically a one-way trade. Britain wanted Chinese silk, China, tea, handicraft, and even agricultural produce such as rhubarb. And the Chinese didn't want anything from England. So the Opium War, at that time, China was strategically very much of Middle Kingdom. But within one generation, China somehow became what the Japanese later called the segment of East Asia, or reduced to a geographic expression. So from the Opium War to the founding of the People's Republic, from 1939 to 1949, 110 years, every decade, something dramatic changed. The Taiping Rebellion, the unequal treaties, Japanese aggression, the Boxer Rebellion that provoked the alliance of eight superpowers to fight against China, the collapse of the Manchu Dynasty, the warlord period, the conflict between the nationalists and the communists. And then after the founding of the People's Republic, on the surface, China became unified, but every 5 years, there was a dramatic change. The Korean War in the early 50s, the Great Leap Forward, that led to major disaster, the 3 years of famine. According to one account, that's an official account, 20 million people died of starvation. And according to unofficial, maybe 35 million or more. And then collectivization, communization, and the Great Cultural Revolution that led to the total disruption of Chinese, not only government, economics, but society as a whole. If we look at the ideological front, it's important to know that since the May 4th period of 1919, Chinese intellectuals, overwhelmed by the situation in China, and of course the attractiveness of the Enlightenment mentality of the modern West, totally reject the Chinese indigenous traditions, not just Confucianism, but Buddhism, Taoism, and so forth. And there was a very vibrant period in the 20s that China really wanted to become westernized. All major Western trends of thought, anarchism, German idealism, French vitalism with Bergson, and British liberalism and American pragmatism, all became very, very important in China. John Dewey actually spent 2.5 years in China, and interestingly, he actually wrote a secret statement to the State Department, and it was just released in the last 3 years, and he predicted China would never become socialist, let alone communist. That's John Dewey, the great public philosopher. And because the assumption was there were so many possibilities for China to move, and socialism and communism was not necessarily a viable approach. And yet, if we see China, especially Chinese intellectuals, were obsessed with two problems. One, that China could not save herself simply by appeal to its own tradition, indigenous tradition, no matter how rich and varied those traditions were. And so China will have to learn from the West. And there's also a fierce nationalism and patriotism. And the notion that we are miserable, humiliated, impotent, and hopeless on the one hand, and the determination that we shall overcome and we will prevail. These two contradictory forces are very powerful. So when 1917, the establishment of the Soviet Union, with the Leninist idea of anti-imperialism, the Chinese intellectuals observed that Marxism was Western to the core, at one point considered the most advanced development of Western ideas of the Enlightenment. At the same time, it was anti-West. So it became extremely attractive to the Chinese. That became a kind of irreversible trend. So in the 80s, many scholars believe, including Zhao Fushan and the vice president of Chinese Academy, that China could, in fact, combine three major traditions and in order to develop its own ideological orientation. Liberalism, with the democratic tendencies from the West, socialism as part of the Chinese legitimacy, and Confucianism, the possibility for cultural identity. And yet, at the time, the young people were so overwhelmed by two, from their point of view, powerful forces. One, socialism they perceived as a kind of Stalinistic dictatorial control. And Confucianism was considered as the feudal past. The collision of these two forces was so powerful that China was not able to modernize, to develop. So to become modern, China would have to learn from the West again. So liberalism by far was the most powerful force in China. And that, of course, led to the confrontation of the Tiananmen tragedy. And right now, in the 20th century, with all the issues that Rob pointed out, there was the possibility of imagining another combination, the combination of the liberal democratic tendencies, irreversible and unstoppable, including the market economy, and the socialism as justice and distributive justice, to be sure, at legitimacy of the party for the time being, and Confucianism reemerged as a new form of cultural identity. It is obvious that a very remarkable transformation on the cultural scene has taken place, not just the economic vibrancy, in the last 20 years or so. And I gave a lecture on Confucian humanism in China at the Peking University, 1985. The change was rather dramatic. The boundary crossing is evident in several spheres of interest: government, business, mass media, the professions, and social movements. Virtually all major universities have a center of Confucian learning or classical studies now. Many institutes of higher learning offer lifelong education courses for emphasis on Confucian ethics to business executives and government officials. Books on classical Chinese studies and Confucian classics are sold all very well all through China. For example, a commentary on the Analects, that one of the four Confucian classics, sold so well in the first months, probably 3 million. As a result, that broke all the records. The emergence of this particular kind of discourse definitely symbolizes a fundamental and thorough rejection of the anti-tradition mentality. It is also an acknowledgement of the politically concerned, socially engaged, and culturally sensitive intellectuals in China that the ideological welcome and the corrosive power of the market with its excessive commercialism that have seriously eroded public mores and substantially undermined the effectiveness of the body politic will have to be somewhat redirected. So in the reform and open era, especially after Deng Xiaoping's visit to the South in 1992, China's newly recognized status as economic power, of course with political influence, raises the fundamental question about Chinese cultural identity. What is the meaning of being Chinese in this particular context? Yet, to the Chinese public intellectuals, beneath the apparent economic achievement the social cost, inequality, insecurity, incivility, and disharmony is high, and the felt need of a sense of direction is very strong and urgent. Concerns for the blatant lack of social capital, not enough cultural competence, ethical intelligence, and spiritual values at all institutional levels throughout the country loom large in their minds. So whether China is a question that weighs heavily upon the conscience of all reflective minds in the cynic world. When I say the cynic world, I call cultural China, not just the mainland, but Taiwan, Hong Kong, Macau, Singapore, and the Chinese diaspora. There's a burning desire to find a solution to what one scholar, Feng Qi, characterized as the contestation between tradition and modernity in the China and the West. With a view toward the future, China's modernization cannot be guided by unflinching faith in materialism, instrumental rationality, progressivism, and social engineering. Policies formulated by the technocratic mentality without reference to culture and ethics are not sustainable. In a deeper sense, a critical reflection on the strengths and limitation of the modernistic mentality by tapping into traditional resources is both necessary and desirable for formulating a wholesome cultural identity. This question of the cultural identity has been very greatly, very, very important and widely acknowledged by the Chinese intellectuals. When I use the word intellectuals, I refer to some members of the government, the academic community, the business community, professions, and all the other arenas in the political context. The 2004 Beijing Declaration, signed by all 70 or so participants, politicians, scholars, writers, artists, editors, entrepreneurs, and entertainers, in a cultural summit organized by the concerned intellectuals, both in government, academia, mass media, and business, is an indication of a kind of wishful thinking, but that wishful thinking may turn out to be consequential. The idea is Chineseness will have to be understood from a pluralistic, tolerant, and dialogical perspectives. And this is emerging. It's a hopeful sign. It is difficult and complex to cultivate this kind of idea. So the notion about Chinese subjectivity is now understood. It has to be pluralistic, not only internally in terms of various kinds of nationalities, but in reference to Japan, to Korea, and of course the larger world outside. This is also the sense that this subjectivity has to be self-reflexive and has to be open. The danger of nationalism is there, but nationalism is not the only choice. In terms of diplomacy, China is being relatively successful in developing, quote, a harmonious approach, especially China's relationship with ASEAN. And they recognize the consensus formation there. And in terms of the European community and even the United States, there's a very high level of tolerance. And there's a deep concern about China's, not just the public image, but the international image. But domestically, it is extremely complicated for China to go through the process of understanding some of the richest cultural resources over the years they cultivated by China and maintain China as one of the continuous civilizations, the longest continuous civilizations in the world. Some of these ideas need to be identified, and it's now increasingly recognized by at least a group of intellectuals. First of all, this notion about a humanistic vision, it should encompass nature and religion in its orientation. This is a critique of the Enlightenment version of secular humanism, which ignores the spiritual realm on the one hand and the natural order on the other. There's also the assumption, which is deeply rooted in Buddhism and Confucianism, that a concrete living person is a central relationship. As a center, The dignity, independence, and autonomy of the individual is an essential feature of the person. As relationships, sociality is indispensable for personal identity. So this whole question about interplay, hopefully fruitful interplay, between the self, not as an isolated individual, and society. This is the theoretical basis of harmonious society. Unfortunately, it is important to know the idea of harmony is based upon difference. Uniformity is the opposite of harmony. The Confucian idea of the person is rooted in the body, home, community, and the world here and now. There's no notion about a spiritual sanctuary outside of the world here and now, either the kingdom of God yet to come or the other shore. Therefore, to deal with the world here and now as the lived reality is absolutely critical. And in this sense, the world, the secular world, is from this highly idealized vision, is a sacred by overcoming some of the very powerful dichotomous modes of thinking in the world today. Body and mind, spirit and matter, creator and creature, and sacred and profane. So this notion about the ability of a person through sensitivity to embody heaven and earth and mirror things, this is deeply, again, rooted in both Buddhist and Confucian thought, in one's own sensitivity and consciousness. Finally, although cultural diversity is taken for granted, it is important to quest for harmony without uniformity and look for the great unity through the education of global citizenship. So the message, I think, for the kind of Chinese cultural identity in the most positive sense is to say all spiritual traditions in the world will have to develop two languages. One is the language specific to one's own faith community or one's own nation. The Christians have the Christian language, the Buddhists have the Buddhist language, the Muslims have the Islamic language, the Confucians have the Confucian language. The second language is the language of global citizenship. It is the idea of the global citizenship rooted in the Chinese conception of the great unity that may serve as a form of humanistic vision that will encompass at least four dimensions: the self, the community, nature, and heaven. Hopefully, the integration of the body and mind of the self, fruitful interaction between self and community, variously understood from the family to the global community, and sustainable harmonious nature between human species and nature, and mutuality and mutual responsiveness between the human heart and mind and the way of heaven, or God, or Allah. Thank you.
Ming, I'll let you sit down without tripping over your wires. It's Rod made the allusion to American ideals, and it's July 4th tomorrow, and all over the country, people will be hearing about liberty, equality, the pursuit of happiness. At equivalent times in China, you're suggesting that there is really nothing there that the leaders can talk about that have that kind of significance. But I wonder, Wei Ming, if you necessarily agree with that, because you seem to think, Rod, that this notion or the mantra in China today about harmonious society is essentially hollow, and it's the latest in a series of ideologies without real substance. Yet I sense that you may not agree with that, or that there is some tradition, whether it's Confucian or Taoist or otherwise, in this notion of harmony that may in fact resonate with the Chinese people and that may help us understand China in a way that's different from how our understanding of our own society.
I think I agree with Rod's rather critical reflection on the idea of harmonious society, because it can very well be used as a mechanism for uniformity, for control. And yet, if we look at this question of harmony, which is a very powerful idea in China, an essential feature of harmony is difference. for example, music instruments. The word harmony in Chinese is basically audio. You have to have many different kinds of musical instruments to make harmonious music. You have to have many different colors to make a beautiful painting, and you have to have all kinds of ingredients in order to make a beautiful soup. And in that connection, I think one strength of not just China, but East Asia, I consider important, is that ever since the Opium War, the Chinese are totally committed to this idea of a learning society. Everybody's involved in learning. Very deeply. I think the first word in the Analects is learning. Of course, learning to be human, broadly defined. If you look at Japan, Dutch learning, French learning, German learning, more recently American learning, China too. So this incredible commitment to learning, of course, education broadly defined, and also this commitment that no matter what, these advanced Western societies offer so much for us. So I think the Sino-American relationship is perhaps one of the most important bilateral relationships in the world, and it is very, very asymmetrical. China wants very much to learn from every aspect of American society. And in our society, the situation is changing very gradually. There's a certain kind of inattention to China. Now, the big question for me, especially from the American side, we've transformed ourselves into basically a teaching civilization. When the end of history was talked about by Fukuyama, the notion is very little we can learn from anyone. Market economy, democratic politics, civil society, science and technology, we've made it. And this reminds me of a very interesting Indian scholar by the name Ashish Nandi. He said he has many, many friends in Cambridge, Mass., but he really doesn't want to visit Harvard. Every time he visits Harvard, it's an agonizing experience. I said, why? He said, if we sit beside a friend we know personally very well, but deep in his heart or her heart, there's the assumption that your present is our distant past, and our present is your distant future. If you're involved in that kind of a dialogical relationship, it's very difficult to do. I think that's something I think the mindset in the West, in America in particular, will have to be changed.
Come back to this notion of harmony, because obviously, as Raymond says, harmony is very important, and most people, most of the time, including China, don't want anything other than harmony in the sense that they don't want more cultural revolutions and so on. The problem for people in China today, and why I think harmony is a hollow word, is that their daily experience is of massive official corruption. Their daily experience is of land grabs of their fields, knocking down of their houses to build factories locally, and that they may feel that the government actually at the center has got the right ideas. Certainly, Wen Jiabao, the prime minister, talks the talk, but the local officials walk a very different walk. And so the idea of harmony when the central government cannot protect people, and instead there have to be, these are official figures, I think in 2005, 87,000 demonstrations, riots, whatever, suggests that the idea of harmony to the average person in China is something they'd love to see, but it has to be harmony with justice, and justice and lack of exploitation, lack of corruption, they don't see around them. Let me just say one thing about what Weiming said about the Sino-American relationship, but I agree is absolutely central. I think one of the things that the Chinese most want in the world, and it comes out of this feeling of having been exploited, having been downtrodden during the period of the Opium War and onwards, is that they want to be respected again. They would like to be respected as in the old way, when China was actually the center of the known universe of East Asia. But they, at least they want respect as a great nation, which is now building itself up so tremendously. And the respect they most want is that of the United States, because the United States, for them, is the major player in the world. And their problem is that they don't see themselves getting that respect unless there's a change in the political system, and that's what the party doesn't want.
Let's just stay on that notion of respect and the Chinese image that they'd like to have in the world. You know, what the reality is and what the aspiration is. How do you explain, for example, and maybe this is just the difference between the elites and others and the control of opinion, but how do you explain the apparent indifference to the world's attitude about China's relationship, for example, in Sudan and Darfur? Or is this just an entirely pragmatic notion that the energy needs are insatiable and it's something that we have to do, versus, on the other hand, the enormous pride that the Chinese are obviously taking in the Olympic Games coming up? Mm-hmm. How do you explain those things?
The psychological dynamics is complex. China just hosted one of the largest summit with African countries. More than 40 or 50 leaders showed up. Even during the Cultural Revolution, when China was not at all interested in oil, China's relationship with many of the African countries was very strong. I think one thing about China I think we need to be aware of, because of the Middle Kingdom syndrome, it's very cosmopolitan in terms of the overall vision of the world. There's a deep assumption that those who are more powerful, those meaning individuals and groups, more influential, have more access to information ideas, ought to be more obligated for the well-being of the community as a whole. So one criticism of China, especially among some of the elite students, is that why the United States cannot go beyond national interest. And they do not know that Tip O'Neill has made the remark, all politics is local. And in fact, recently I was involved in a conference organized by Interaction Council. Mandel was invited as a speaker. The question was raised, why it's so difficult for America to rise above a national interest vis-a-vis, say, United Nations or all kinds of international organizations. And Mandel's response is, if we have national interest, it's good enough because we have too many local interests. But in the Chinese case, I think Rod is absolutely right that the central government now is losing certain kind of control. The local governments became very powerful. So that indicates the possibility of a pluralistic tendency. I think there's no question about the central government or the local government's intention to have totalistic control. You know, they even try to control Google, the internet. But the whole political system is very porous. It's so porous, there's so many public space for exploration. That's why in art, you know, some of the artists like Yang Wei, they say, well, I don't feel any kind of control. I can do a lot of things. He went to one art show. This is a very powerful denunciation of the Tiananmen because with all the tanks and so forth, and it's there. So the government may have a tremendous interest in trying to control, but China is now so vibrant and developing so many areas become free zones for all kinds of interesting things. However, I think one danger is the government always reserves the right to come to you afterwards. So there's certain kind of restraint. But my sense that process, I agree with Rod, no matter what kind of democracy eventually will emerge, that process is unstoppable. But I think we should make distinction between two kinds of democracy. One is what Schumpeter would say, election and multi-parties. If you don't have election, you don't have multi-parties, there's no democracy. The other position is also very powerful. I think maybe Sandel, maybe Amartya Sen and others. I think I include myself in that, is to broaden the public space for public reasoning. Now, if you have a very broad base and people through the internet and all kinds of other areas will be able to articulate their concerns, and their concerns will influence policy. So the government gradually realizes the government will have to be a restrained government rather than the government to penetrate into every areas. With that opening, which of course the major debate in China is whether public intellectuals ought to do something that they've never been able to do. In other words, all these arenas in the civil society, mass media, business, all kinds of social organizations, now recently including NGOs, for for environmental concerns because the environment is in terrible shape. So these forces, when they begin, it's not a civil society in the modern sense, but it's pluralistic and it opens up all kinds of other possibilities.
Please.
Come back to Darfur, but say something about what you said. I think you're right. I think there was a sort of unspoken social contract after Tiananmen. Namely, you can do what you want as long as you don't denounce the Communist Party or its leadership in Tiananmen Square. You can go and do almost anything. As Weiming rightly said, if we decide afterwards that you did the wrong thing, we'll knock on your door. But at least it's a much freer society in that sense. They do not have control of this society any longer. It's like that diagram I tried to illustrate the present situation with. I think that on the question of Darfur, the Chinese do want respect, and they are very dismayed at the Darfur issue. I think what you have to understand is that with the collapse of the Soviet Union and the disappearance of communism in Eastern Europe, the Chinese have felt immensely threatened. They know much better than I do, or Wei Ming does, how unstable their society is potentially. That this is 1.3 billion people and they can't control them any longer in the way that they did in the Maoist era. So they're very uneasy. And one of the ways that they want to try and deal with that uneasiness is to make sure that the economic engine keeps running. And to keep the economic engine running, they have to have oil, among other things. And that's what they've been trying to do in Darfur, in Sudan and in other countries. And so they are fixed with a dilemma on this. This is their national interest, to be in the Sudan and to have their oil. They know they're going to have to make some kind of noises. They do not want Steven Spielberg to be forced to withdraw from planning the Olympics. But they are very much caught in the dilemma. They want respect. They realize that human rights in foreign countries are an issue. They don't know how to deal with it, frankly.
We're going to open up questions in just a minute. I just want to ask Rod one question, though. You speak about the vacuum at the heart of Chinese ideology today. But how do you explain that Mao's portrait is still in Tiananmen Square? I mean, why?
Because they're clinging to the last fig leaves of legitimation. You know, after the Cultural Revolution, which was such a disaster that the Chinese had to do bravely compared with the Soviet Union and Stalin, where there was only a secret speech, they had to publicly announce what they felt about Mao and the Cultural Revolution. They effectively said these were mistakes, grave mistakes in launching the Cultural Revolution, but they were mistakes of a great Marxist-Leninist. Mao has been held up to kids for the last 60 years as the man who led the Communist Party to victory. If Mao is now taken down, if his body is removed from Tiananmen Square, why are you guys in power? That's the problem.
One question, and then do we have microphones on the side, or how are we going to do this? I can't see. All right, so people could line up, and then Wei Ming has one comment before that.
One anecdote to this. During the Cultural Revolution, all major universities, without exception, built huge sculptures of Mao, 10 feet or the kind. So the first thing after Deng Xiaoping's reform and open policy, they tried to get rid of it. And they were so successful. Peking University, I was so annoyed by these two huge statues. I was teaching that. Once I woke up, they're gone. They were exploded overnight. And this is true with all the major universities, with exception maybe two or three. So on the one hand, you have Mao, Tiananmen, but Mao disappeared in many of the major university campuses.
Okay, I think I see Jim Fallows over here.
Yes, I'm Jim Fallows from the Atlantic Monthly, and I have a question for Professor McFarquhar. Preface by saying I've very much enjoyed your latest book, which I read just before coming here, and also your presentation here. There was one part of what you said right at the end where I wonder if you could spell out the logic a little further. You concluded your comments by saying that the regime would have to take steps towards democratization. And my understanding has been that's one of several alternatives, but I wonder if you could spell out the mechanism by which they would have to do that as opposed to considering it. Just one other thing. I've been living in Shanghai for the last year, and my sense very much, as you say, is that there is a social contract where as long as people don't criticize the regime, you know, that they can do more or less what they want. And an alternative hypothesis is that can go on for quite a long time, as long as people's paychecks are rising. So could you spell out the logic, please?
Yes. Shanghai is a reasonably well-run city, and it's a very prosperous city. So, of course, the the dimensions of the problem are not immediately visible there. I think the logic is the following. If you're unable to control your local politicians, and the situation is roughly as follows. Weiming described how they were out of control. There are two norms for a local politician wishing to rise. One is to develop the local economy, and the other is law and order. And so what the local boss will say to the central government is, yes, of course I confiscated this land, of course I built a factory there, and of course there was some to-ing and fro-ing between me and the leader of the factory, but there was a riot, and we put it down. What we have is, we have peace now, we put it down, and we have development. Isn't that what you want? Now, I think that the logic of the way it goes is that the central government has to start bringing these people under control. And they don't know how to do it. And if they start to do it by, say, increasing the level of democratization, I mean, the village elections don't amount to much. They do give peasants a sense of what it is to cast a vote, but they have a choice between two candidates chosen or three candidates chosen by the party. It's not real democracy. You know, in democracy, you can choose any scoundrel or wastrel as your leader. But I think they have to somehow divert attention from people finally blaming them by enabling people to blame the locality and do something about it. So I see the possibility of democratization as the way of the center divesting itself of the blame for everything that goes wrong at the local level in China. Whether it'll happen that way or not, I don't know. As I said in my remarks, the experience has been that major changes in China over the last 150 years have been as a result of massive traumas, and we hope that won't happen. But it's a process where, I mean, look at what's happening in China in the next few months. There's going to be a party congress, and there's going to be a new leader chosen, apparently, who will take over from Hu Jintao in 5 years' time at the subsequent party congress. We don't yet know how that leader will be chosen. This is the top of the Communist Party of China. Who chose Hu Jintao? Deng Xiaoping. Who chose Jiang Zemin? Deng Xiaoping and his colleagues. Will they trust Hu Jintao to choose his successor? Doubtful. So how do they choose it? So maybe the democratization will have to start at the top, that the Politburo will have to be allowed to elect its next leader. Or maybe, horror of horrors, the Central Committee, as the Constitution suggests, will be allowed to do that. But that's a bit dangerous. So let's have it at the Politburo level. So at both the top level and at the bottom level, there are impulses which should move towards some kind of democratization.
Weiming, did you have something to add there?
I think if democracy is understood as a process of opening up the regime to all kinds of challenges, my sense is that right now, there's no leader who's able to dictate what's going on. It's collective leadership. And I wouldn't be surprised there would be voting within the top leadership in order to identify it. And that mechanism, in fact, a few years ago, Deng Xiaoping even made the observation that the Taiwan model or some other models are very acceptable. So the imagination is there. But the danger is also there. Even if Hu Jintao said, we should go for democracy.
He'd be out.
he may be out. So this kind of collective leadership, both there's certain kind of cohesiveness within, but also they know how powerful the opposition is. So I think not necessarily a contract, but some kind of negotiation, some kind of action out of necessity will lead to a process which is more democratic, freer. And I think the possibility of going back to any of the model, either the strong man of Mao that's out of the question, or even the strong personality like Deng. And the possibility for Hu Jintao to name his successor, you know, whether it Li Keqiang or anyone else, is highly unlikely.
I think actually a model of democratization could be if the party decided to go the Japanese route. I mean, the Liberal Democratic Party has been running Japan for most of the last 60, 70 years with factions. The Chinese party ideology is against factions. If they allowed factions, they would have a more open society.
Do we have a question over here. And if just identify yourself and ask.
Hi, my name is Weena Zhao, and I am a Bezos Aspen Scholar from San Francisco. I just wanted to ask, what do you think of the uneven economic distribution in China? I mean, a country is only as great as its weakest area. How can China improve itself holistically and not just like focus on areas such as Shanghai?
Well, one answer obviously is that Deng Xiaoping, when he came to power, said, as I think I mentioned in my remarks, we have got to develop this country quickly, otherwise we're going to be thrown out. And so he coined the phrase, or someone coined the phrase, and it was adopted as part of the Deng nostrums, some will get rich before others. Now, that has happened in spades. China has diverged from the normal East Asian development model where equality was maintained right through the development system. And now China is the most unequal society in East Asia in terms of income. Now, Deng Xiaoping had one aim, this rapid development, and that has happened. I think that Hu Jintao and Wen Jiabao, the prime minister, had, to their credit, have a different aim. And they are attempting to spread the wealth, to put money into the far west, into the northwest. But it'll be a slow process, because if you have a system whereby the state development model is not in vogue, you've got to depend on private enterprise. And I know that some years ago they took some Hong Kong entrepreneurs up to the northwest to, you know, encourage development, and they got a few thousand dollars out of it, and that was all. So it's a problem. But at least they're now seized of that issue.
We'll go back to this side.
Yes, my name is Bob Monks. What are the prospects for China being able to harmoniously accommodate an economic reality in which Japan plays a continuing major role?
I'll respond to the earlier question briefly, then I come to this one. And I think the assumption is the richer becomes richer, the poor not necessarily become poorer. And now with approaching 200 million Chinese workers moving from the countryside to the urban centers, just imagine any society with that kind of movement or internal migration, stability would be really a serious matter. And yet, these workers believe that they can earn enough and then return to the countryside to help their rural community. So this kind of internal migration may turn out to be certain kind of feedback mechanism for the equality. Japan. Now, China's relationship with Japan is extremely complex. Now, China requires heavily upon Japan's investment and Japan's economic aid. Now, by the way, China's economy, even now, is still one-third of Japan's. Before the reform and change, it was one-tenth. On the other hand, China is critically aware that Japan is going through a very difficult process of re-Asianization. You know, Japan had been extremely successful in internationalization and localization, which means indigenization. But in the last 10 years or so, Japan is trying to re-Asianize. Now, Japan is confronted with not just China, but also Korea. In that particular context, a new contract of some kind will have to be worked out. And yet, there are two factors extremely difficult for Beijing to handle. One is the American factor. The other one is the Taiwan factor. Japan still believes that Li Denghui and others show that it's very close relationship in terms of not just trade, but ethos between Japan and Taiwan. So how to deal with that kind of situation looms large in the minds of the Chinese leadership. One last point is that when I was in China in the 80s, I was amazed by the fact that in the public TV, the sitcoms, and also the movies, the overwhelming majority of them were about the Second World War, about Japanese aggression. So even the younger people were seasoned in that kind of anti-Japanese sentiments, partly because the rise of Chinese Communist Party, a very important feature of that, is unification of China. And that is predicated in China's ability to fight against Japanese aggression. And would that change? I think it will. Because in Japan, I also spent some time in Japan, the sense of nervousness is no longer there. The Japanese society as a whole takes this in a very, not necessarily relaxed manner, but in a manner that is both reasonable and in the long run may even be sustainable.
I think one of the factors in the relationship with Japan was that, and this is why the defeat in the war of 1894-95 was so traumatic, was that the Japanese, if the Chinese were being nice, were referred to as younger brothers. If they're being nasty, they referred to them with other language throughout history. And the problem that Japan confronted China with was that it was now not part of the greater East Asian Confucian-dominated co-prosperity sphere, one might use that term, but it was now another. It was different. It was a separate nation state on the Western lines. And indeed, Japan served a very healthy purpose for China because it forced China to realize it too was a nation state. And that's one of the things that the Chinese have been coming to grips with. But I think that the problem for the leadership is that anti-Japanese sentiment is there, fueled by things like those films that you saw and by various slights that are taken to a great extent by the Chinese. And it's something that the Chinese government is overconscious of. They cannot allow nationalism to run riot because anti-Japanese sentiment is likely to be the way it'll go. And if they don't deal with the Japanese in some way that the public might want, they'll turn against them.
Question over here.
Doreen Kaur, could you comment on China's relationship with Taiwan and its impact on its relationship with the United States?
Just briefly, if I look, you know, I look at it from the cultural point of view, and it's quite interesting that right now, maybe even Shanghai area itself, more than a million or so Taiwanese businessmen have taken residence in the Shanghai area. But if you say throughout China, we're talking about 2 million or more. And there's a lot of tourism across the straits, a lot of scholarly exchanges, and a lot of other kind of communications. The only groups in Beijing and in Taipei that are basically ignorant of each other turn out to be the top leaders. And these top leaders are going to determine what the future of this relationship will be. Now, in the classical Confucian tradition, the way the big that serves the small is the spirit of humanity, allowing the small to have enough space to move around. But Beijing is now finding every possibility to isolate Taiwan. So you have to recognize one China and so forth. Now, the idea of the small to serve the big is to serve with a certain sense of reverence and certain sense of respect. But Taiwan's leadership is doing everything to provoke Beijing for response, for its domestic political benefit. So the situation is very, very unstable. And I'm really deeply worried about the situation. Now, I met quite a few Chinese on the mainland, and they talk about Taiwan's democracy, and they admire that. But I said, if democracy leads to Taiwan independence, they said, we have to use military might to fight against it. So this sense of patriotism, nationalism on the one hand, and the importance of democracy and freedom on the other, I think, unfortunately, the overwhelming majority of the Chinese culture and political elite now opt for a certain form of cultural identity, unification of all the territories, therefore implicitly nationalistic tendency.
Very sorry, but we're going to have to end this conversation because we're going to have another session in here in 10 minutes. I want to thank Rod and Wei Ming very, very much.